Welcome to Fast Forward, presented by Commotion, your regular glimpse into the future of urban mobility. I'm your host, Greg Lindsay, Director of Strategy for Commotion, and as always, I'm joined by Jonah Bliss, VP of Media and Marketing for Commotion. Welcome back, Jonah. We missed you last week.
I missed you, Greg, and listeners. But it sounds like you had a lot of fun with the Motivate SoCal event, so don't forget about little old me.
We did indeed. I would say my biggest takeaway from Motivate SoCal, for those of you who had a chance to listen to some of what we talked about last week in our panel with Jessica Robinson and Sam Adams, but missed the main event, I fell in love with an electric tractor, Monarch Tractors. Building basically EV tractors, all in the name of collecting data on fields. It proved to me as a startup pitch that literally everything is about extracting as much data as possible from whatever it is you're ostensibly serving, whether that is a field or whether that is the curb or whether it is the anything in the urban realm.
I can only imagine the targeted Instagram ads that digital farmers must get.
That's true. It is interesting that their first customers were vineyards. So, you know, there's influencers in everything, let me tell you. But before we get into this week, I want to make sure that I prime our guests because it's very topical this week. We'll be hearing shortly from Giovanni Bertolino, who is the head of e-mobility in North America for Enel X. And Enel, for those of you who know, is the fairly progressive Italian electric utility that has moved much more aggressively than its American counterparts into renewables. So we're going to hear about their investments there, which ties into the Ford F-150 Lightning and a lot of developments this week, starting with, Jonah, have we finally reached the end of oil?
Is this the Kunstler cast now for peak oil?
Well, you know, the Stone Age did not end by running out of stones, unlike Kunstler believes. Hopefully the end of oil will be able to simply move past it, or perhaps shareholder advocacy will drive oil away, which seems to be the case at ExxonMobil.
It's been a pretty rocky week. I think it's two, maybe even three new directors joining the board, right? Kind of part of a activist-led push to kind of move the oil tanker in a different direction.
Totally. What's really interesting about this is, I mean, the directors themselves, one is from an environmental outfit, another one was chosen from a refinery company, the third might actually come from Google X of all places. But what's really interesting there is that, you know, it was led by an activist hedge fund, but, and, you know, again, readers of Matt Levine and followers of this, you know, Joan and I love him, is it seems to be fitting his hypothesis that really, you know, the 12 massive index funds that own the entire market have fallen in line behind this group, you know, Engine One, demanding this sort of change. And so BlackRock, Vanguard, all of them writing letters saying they would support this. And yeah, there are now two, maybe three outsiders on the board who are pressing hard for ExxonMobil to rethink its entire existence as an oil super major. So that's really interesting. And in addition to that, there was the whole Dutch court ruling, mm-hmm. for those of you who might have seen that, you know, literally Dutch activists went to the court system there because Shell is headquartered in The Hague to basically force Shell to cut its carbon intensity of operations by 45% by 2030. So again, it's hard to see how you can remain an oil company and cut your carbon emissions. So Shell started to pivot. They're going to have to pivot a lot faster.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess the devil's going to be the details of if that's, you know, direct emissions versus, you know, the emissions that their product induces, I suppose. But either way, it's interesting to see the kind of levers of capitalism start to kind of push in a greener direction. So fingers crossed.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see if they create Bad Shell and to simply move it all off the books, you know, yeah. While it still exists.
Sell it to Venezuela.
Well, speaking of formerly polluting industries trying to turn a greener leaf, the biggest development in automotive OEMs in the past few weeks was the debut of the Ford F-150 Lightning. And of course, the F-150, America's best-selling vehicle for going on several decades now. But interesting in a couple of respects, Joe. I mean, it's under $40,000 mm-hmm. is the targeted price. Also, it's 6,000 pounds, so it's like half again as big as
two Toyota Corollas, I think. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. We can now use Corollas as a unit of measurement, and my favorite piece of it is part of the messaging is like, yeah, if your house loses power, you can run your house for 3 days off your F-150. So, you know, just really leaning into sort of the climate change dystopia when the grid goes down in Austin during the next winter storm. So. I don't know. What are your thoughts, Joe? This whole thing of selling electric mobility to Americans by building the biggest Hummer F-150 you can buy, it seems to be the direction.
I mean, it seems like these things weigh as much as an RV. So if this is all about survivalism, why not just, where's my electric RV, I suppose? But no, I mean, it's just from an engineering standpoint, right, as the dear president said, this sucker's quick. So to get 6,500 pounds moving that quickly is, you know, a testament to the power of electric torque. But the other end of the equation is just, you know, do you want that barreling down your street, you know, flattening your child? It's just obviously it's, you know, better than the gasoline equivalent, but it's still a lot of just energy to move anything that heavy around.
Yeah, and it is interesting. I mean, this it just goes to show that this is the direction, you know, under Biden's America that it's going to go in, right? Well, I think all the, you know, walkable urbanism advocates and climate advocates sort of knew that the compromise measure was going to be you get to keep your giant vehicle, but it's going to be electric, and then maybe it's going to be green. And seeing this too, like, you know, the measure in California that, you know, that ride-hailing fleets, mm-hmm. you know, the platforms have to ensure that 90% of the vehicle miles will be fully electric. Well, great. That will still, of course, mean massive VMT in cities. That will still mean all of the problems of congestion in the urban realm that Uber and Lyft have created, but they'll at least be electric by then. So it'll be interesting. Because in addition to that, what's the other rumor that's coming out of Ford now? And you know, just as they're doubling down on the F-150, there's, you know, more movement
happening. It makes sense. If they're going big, they might divest from small. So there's some rumors swirling around Spin, which is, of course, their micromobility scooter sharing startup they bought a few years back, which is, I think they're actually, you know, kind of early on the trend. But it looks like they're having second thoughts and looking to possibly divest. So,
yes, which is interesting. I just want to shout out Spin, the earliest partner in Commotion. We have a special place in our hearts for the Spin folks there. But it is interesting. This is not Jim Hackett's Ford anymore, right? Like, you know, they're progressing with Michigan Central Depot and investing in this. But like, this is Farley's Ford, and they're going heavy into the biggest vehicle. So, again, the bad signs here about, you know, a pivot away from, you know, micromobility by mainstream there and getting into a very large scale EVs. But speaking of EVs, and also speaking of like oddities in the market, and speaking of Ford in a way, like, you know, just as Ford once had the River Rouge plant where they supposedly turned, you know, sand into glass for the Model T windshields, now the O'Caron thing to do is to buy your own chip foundry to get away around it. So who's thinking about buying their own chips?
Need we even ask this rhetorical question that if someone's going to make the next Fordlandia, it's going to be Musktopia.
And he's building it in Texas, you poor residents of Brownsville. Yeah. Yes, exactly. The Fordlandia of chips, Elon Musk.
But yeah, so it looks like, you know, kind of undoing a lot of the few last decades of common wisdom about, you know, what you in-house, what you out-house, outsource in your company. Tesla is considering, you know, buying its own chip foundry, which, you know, makes sense in the kind of, you know, recent era of chip shortages and supply chain hiccups. But I think questions about, you know, are we going to be looking at those same sort of problems forever? And does it really make sense to take this, pretty, you know, important capability in-house?
Yeah, it's as a signal of like just how tightening and how increasingly, you know, the tight the chip crisis has gotten. It's interesting that Tesla would even consider this, but it reeks of Delta Airlines buying its own oil, you know, refinery a while back, you know, which did not work out too well.
No one told them about hedges.
Yes, exactly. So it'll be interesting. But yeah, but the fact that this is now, you know, a viable scenario that, you know, an integrated OEM needs its own chip foundry. And this is happening. We've talked about before that, like, you know, Volkswagen, you know, is thinking about designing its own chips. That's the state we're in now. Or like everybody wants to make its own silicon, whether you're Apple or Tesla or Volkswagen. So, well, you know, that increasing
I can't wait to run the Volkswagen chips on like a PC benchmark and then realize that they're cheating too.
Oh, that was really cruel and yet totally justified, Jonah. So salute you for that one. We'll figure out how they work around there. Well, speaking of dirty tricks there, what is the latest in SPAC world, Jonah? So much fun SPAC news.
It's
we thought it was over, but it's still going.
Yeah, you know, it seems like the SPAC land bottomed out a few weeks ago. So it's not all gloom and doom now. It's kind of a fascinating mixed bag, which is why we love SPACs, because they keep us thinking at night. So the big news of the week is EV fast charger developer Tritium, I hope I'm saying that right, is going public, of course, via a SPAC at a $1.2 billion valuation. I think what's kind of sets them apart from, you know, the traditional SPAC players, that this company's, you know, been around for 20 years. They make real money. They're valued at, I think, you know, $1.2 billion, a little bit more in Australian dollars as part of the transaction. And then also interesting, there's no pipe, you know, there's no like sort of private investment portion, which I think, you know, you could read the kind of signals either way here. Either that means that there isn't, you know, appetite for it, which is, you know, perhaps a bad sign, or it could also mean that they're confident enough in the actual, you know, public listing process, they don't feel a need to dilute further. So, you know, either way, real company, real product, real customers. So that's a step up for SPACs.
That's fair on SPAC. But at the same time, what's the whole deal with Velodyne? It's like they're fighting against their own SPAC, or the founder is, if I understand correctly.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this one's almost, it's too convoluted for me to even, you know, think I get my hands on this. But yeah, Velodyne, which I feel like was one of like really the marquee SPACs the last year, right? Where it just made like young founder super rich and kind of like put this, you know, sort of form of fundraising in the public eye. They've basically now gone to war with themselves. So one of the founders was basically ousted by the, you know, new board that was installed as part of this, you know, going public, you know, pseudo purchase, and sort of, you know, competing claims of who's, you know, not being a good fiduciary duty and like, you know, sort of nepotism and blah, 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 blah. So it's messy, it's dirty, it's fun to watch. It's, you know, perhaps a reason why SPACs are not the perfect financial instrument that nobody thought they were.
That's absolutely true. But it is funny how SPACs, you know, and I think this is an interesting case. The other SPAC story that's notable this week is Virgin Galactic, which, you know, to me is fascinating because as someone has written at length about, you know, aviation and whatnot, I mean, Virgin Galactic has like almost become a zombie brand, right? Mm-hmm. I think Richard Branson's been promising suborbital flights since it seems like 2004 or five at this point. And yes, space is hard for sure. But they've gone through all sorts of permutations, and now a SPAC is the latest thing to keep that project going, even though it's been outclassed by, you know, better finance billionaires like, you know, Bezos and Musk there. So yeah, is this, you know, I'll be curious when we reach the whole point of like, you know, where the SPAC companies that should never have been SPACs are still out there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in 5 years when all the lawsuit dust is settled, we'll see who realized some real shareholder value and who just made some money on their way to the Bahamas.
Indeed. Well, jokes and levity aside, before we get to our guest, it is, of course, absolutely deservedly worth noting, of course, that in the past week has been the anniversary of George Floyd's murder in Minneapolis, which, of course, touched off an uprising across America and another grappling with America's racial legacy, which has also prompted a fierce backlash, you know, in Texas and elsewhere, debating the nature of history itself. But yeah, from an urban perspective, Jonah, I'm curious what you've seen or what we've learned from this in the last year. I mean, obviously, there was a lot of soul searching about, you know, what are these improvements to the urban realm even about if not everyone has access to them evenly and if it prompts more encounters with police. And we've seen this from debates about whether we should have more speed cameras and just basically try to reduce encounters with police for Americans. But I'm curious if anything particularly in the currents have stood out for you, Joe.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think you're just dead on there that, yeah, it's to me, it's about the fundamental question of, you know, what is public space? And if, you know, not all people feel comfortable and welcome and safe, then that space isn't truly public. And so, yeah, I just think, yeah, there's been some interesting, you know, kind of looks back over how things have changed in the past year, specifically in Minneapolis, where there's sort of an almost kind of quasi-autonomous space has developed as a, you know, sort of memorial, sort of activist space that's not, you know, particularly, you know, the local PD doesn't seem to really intercede in it very much. So I think that's an interesting example of, yeah, truly like a bottom-up kind of, you know, people-powered public space emerging. So that's, you know, probably more useful than just having more, you know, Starkitect, you know, fancy plazas that are surveilled and, you know, mall policed to death.
Well, speaking of surveillance, my most interesting reflection on this is I was asked to comment by GovTech Skip Deskin, who you know covers a lot of our webinars at Commotion Live. So, Skip, if you're listening, thank you for that. But Skip asked me to comment on a RFP that just went out in New Orleans, basically for municipal broadband, and this ties it back to the smart city and surveillance. And so, the RFP, on the one hand, calls for applicants to, you know, lay out strategies for municipal broadband as part of a way of, you know, of bridging the digital divide in New Orleans. And we've seen this at every level in the States. This is part of course, President Biden's, you know, proposals for infrastructure. But tied to that in it were basically also requirements to do basic digital surveillance through what we've seen in San Diego through their street lamps and elsewhere, ostensibly for the system to pay for itself. And the thing I flagged for Skip there is that, you know, this is basically a poison chalice. This is basically we need to give broadband to marginalized communities, but we also need to surveil them in the process without actually putting in any of the safeguards to prevent that data from being used by police, as it was in San Diego, where, you know, where the data collected by those street lamps were handed over and used to arrest protesters during the George Floyd uprising last year, and you know, leading to all those sort of terrible outcomes in terms of basically lack of accountability and sort of unwarranted surveillance there. So I hope that the respondents at RFP will be able to basically reconcile this, or and we get the kind of, you know, accountability required. This is, you know, not to go too far afield, but, you know, New Orleans, it was revealed by journalists by The Verge 2 years ago, 3 years ago, that, you know, that basically Palantir was building predictive policing models there without any oversight from the city council. It had been kept secret from them. So as we build out the kind of smart infrastructure to make this whole new world of mobility possible, something we talk about here all the time, I do hope that we've learned from the events of last year that we protect the rights of citizens in doing so. So
that would be swell, Greg.
America, it's not too much to ask. All right. Well, now that we've got that out of the way, let's move on to our guests. So Giovanni Bertolino is coming on just a second to talk about Enel's plans here to for electric mobility in the U.S. and sort of how they see the renewables push. So it'll be very interesting to chat with him about whether the end of oil is here at last and what this means and how, and what the Italian version with electric Vespas, I hope, ooh, and all sorts of other fun things, what that means for America. So let's bring on Giovanni. Thanks for joining us, Giovanni.
Thank you, Greg.
I guess as a starting point, can you tell our listeners a bit about Enel? I know you guys mostly through your sponsorship of Formula E, ironically, which is why I guess, of course, motorsport sponsorships exist. But yeah, you're an Italian utility, but of course you have a presence in the United States mostly through charging. So could you talk a bit about how the company came to the States and yeah, your activities here?
Of course. Yeah, actually, the story of Enel presence in North America goes a long way back. I mean, Enel used to be the Italian electric utility, kind of a monopoly. And at the end of 1999, started breakdown, and we sold a lot of assets and transmission network. And with those proceedings, we actually made the first acquisitions in the United States in the year 2000 or 2001. I can't really remember. I wasn't there at the time. It was a small hydro renewable generation company. And from there, we started Enel's journey into renewable energy with Enel Green Power, which is today the largest owner and developer of renewable energy worldwide. Enel is present, yes, it's an Italian company, but it's present really in every continent, 40 states. We manage distribution network in a few countries where we are usually like the largest player. We sell electricity to customers. We serve more than 74 million customers globally. We generate electricity mostly through renewable, and we are gradually phasing out our fossil fuel fleet. And we are helping our customers make a smarter use of electricity and address their energy needs through NLX, which is the division of Enel who really focuses on all other services to customers to make a smarter use of energy, as I said. And within NLX, one of the different things that we do is supporting transition to electric mobility, which means offering hardware and software solutions for smart charging to our customers, as well as electrification of public transportation, like transit buses and school buses.
Great. Well, the obvious question there is sort of is your approach to charging, because if this really seems to be the year commotion to have the focus on building out all of these various charging networks and locations. We've seen across the United States, you know, charging zones by like Revel in New York, for example, and yeah, the sort of realization that, you know, that if the United States is going to make this massive transition to you know, a decarbonized economy, as President Biden has pledged, we're going to have to invest in this. And so, yeah, I'm curious in terms of like what your approach to the charging dilemma and strategy. strategy, particularly given your perspective as an integrated utility? You know all of the challenges in the back end as well as the consumer-facing front end. So how are you bringing that to market with the Juice Box and some of the other innovations that Enel is working on here?
Yeah, absolutely. That is probably, I mean, so far people have been wondering about, you know, or worrying about range anxiety. So that was probably one of the first hurdle to going electric. But now that there are more and more car models available, broadening the choice, and the charging infrastructure is becoming more and more accessible. The real question is, once we move from, you know, 1% of electric vehicles on the street to 10% to 30% to 50%, how is that going to affect the electric grid? How all this, you know, energy that will flow through the grid to charge these cars is going to be generated and transmitted and distributed? And it's undeniable that will be a significant transition. And on one side, we are focusing on, you know, supplying more and more renewable energy to the grid. On the other side, we want to make sure that this load from electric vehicles can be sustained and is how do you say that this load from electric vehicles can be fulfilled by the grid without need of major investments. Mm-hmm. The current grid is actually already able to move much more electricity than today, as it is designed for the peak. So the play there is around making sure we follow a smart charging approach, and that we allocate the charging load where in the moments where it's more acceptable for the grid. And that is really what we focus on. Of course, we have hardware. We have charging hardware that we supply for residential and commercial customers and for public charging. But really, our focus is on the software that manages and control all those chargers and ensures that we can actively manage that load. Of course, the needs of the EV drivers come first, and we need to make sure that they get their car charged when they need to leave. But oftentimes you have more time available than you actually need to charge those vehicles. And then we can optimize when the charging happens in order not to overload the grid. So let's say that you plug the car at 7 p.m. You don't need to start charging right away. You can have the software controlling your charger start later. Or if there is a peak in demand in the grid, you can reduce your charging for a certain period of time to reduce the overload on the grid and avoid the risk of blackout. This is what we are actively doing in California, for instance, where we participate in with the chargers of our customers. We've decided to enroll in this program, providing their flexibility, and we participate to the CAISO energy market by providing that flexibility and demand response. And we also have active programs with utilities where not only we provide utilities the visibility in the charging patterns, but we also help implementing time of use rates or load curtailment programs to adapt the load to the supply. And going forward, this will become more and more critical to ensure that as the load from EVs will grow, the investment required to support that will be kept at the minimum.
Interesting. I'm fond of quoting a stat by Julia Thain, who's now in the mayor of LA's office when she was at Siemens, that, you know, the meeting that for LA to meet its climate goals would require boosting the grid like 1,000%. So obviously building that kind of capacity will take time. So yeah, it's important to figure out how to streamline it. One question I would ask is, obviously, given the fact that you also have this remit on electrifying various fleets of public transportation otherwise, yeah, how do you imagine the fleet rollout of electrification going and sort of your approach to that? Because as Joan and I noted earlier in the podcast, you know, there's the commitment by, I believe in California, for example, by 2030, 90% of ride sharing fleets or, you know, their distributed forms have to be electric VMT. And so I'm very curious how you think that Uber and Lyft and the others might actually carry this out, particularly given since they are so decentralized. So will we see these, like, you know, centralized charging lots for commercial vehicles, or how are you deploying those on behalf of your sort of fleet customers?
I mean, those policies, those mandates are so exciting. I mean, we're gonna experience such a shift in how our transportation is working and the kind of vehicles we drive. It would be amazing. And yes, it's true. Ride sharing fleet, I mean, it's very much decentralized, but there are solutions. So we should not forget that in the United States, 6% of households own a garage. And it's very easy to, you know, add a charger in your garage and have your car fully charged every morning. For those who don't have a garage, I mean, there are solutions for multi-unit dwellings that will allow to charge at night or whenever you're not driving your car. That's, I believe, still the most convenient way to charge. It's most affordable and will give you, as I said, your car fully charged every morning. It's like your phone. Of course, the more you drive during the day, the more there will be a need for charging during the day and or in between your rides. And for that, we're going to see a growing availability of public charging stations in many, many places. There are a lot of commercial real estate, shopping malls, supermarkets that are adding charging stations as an amenity or a service to their customers. We're going to see gas stations adding charging stations to extend their business model also to electric vehicles. And we're going to see locations fully dedicated to electric vehicles with high power chargers, with very dedicated and expensive infrastructure, which will support electric fleets. For the time being, what we are doing is, for instance, we're partnering with Uber, and we are providing to Uber drivers preferential access to our juice box. And we can help them, you know, use our charger, leverage an incentive that might be available for getting a charger installed, and helping them install those chargers. And as we go, we'll continue working with players like them to fulfill that need. And when we launched this partnership with Uber, we used that also to launch Juice Eco, a new product we launched a few months ago. And I think that will be also, I mean, where the industry is going. Electrifying transportation is giving already a huge benefit in reducing emissions, and especially local pollutants that affect the air in our cities. But we're not yet, you know, 100% sure that the electricity we're putting in our car is carbon free, is coming from renewable generation. So with Juice Eco, we're bridging that gap, and basically we're making sure that for every kilowatt hour of electricity you put in your car, there is an equivalent kilowatt hour of renewable energy injected into the grid in North America. So depending on what is your mileage, you know that you are contributing to making sure that there is enough renewable energy to power your drive 100% clean.
Interesting. I was wondering if someone would ever actually, put that sort of auditing feature in place. I mean, obviously the excitement around EVs in the United States is people make that next leap of assumption that the electricity is in fact clean or coming from renewable sources, when often it could be from coal or natural gas still. So it's interesting you're tracking that. But one question I would ask is, obviously, given Enel's global footprint is early in the pandemic, we saw cities like Milan and, of course, Paris and Madrid and of course, in Germany, where there was, you know, subsidies and investments in personal electric mobility in the forms of bikes and e-bikes and scooters, right? There was, you know, all sorts of subsidies being offered by various governments there. And, you know, and obviously different patterns of living too. And so I'm curious, you know, from a policy perspective, you know, here at Commotion, like, we're obviously big fans of personal electric mobility and more active transport. And so I'm curious, like, are there lessons we can learn, or what innovations have you seen in Europe and elsewhere that, you know, would be very interesting to deploy in the US market that could help sort of, again, tip this a push towards, you know, personal, smaller electric devices and simply not just, you know, electrifying the American landscape as it is?
I think we saw very different things. We learned very different things during the pandemic in Europe last year. So first thing, due to the reduction in traffic, in vehicular traffic in the cities, it was very tangible, the reduction in local pollutants. I think people realized how bad internal combustion engines are for the air we breathe. And that sparked a sharp increase in interest for electric vehicles. So that, I believe, has been one key driver of the increase in adoption of electric vehicles in Europe. I mean, if we look at 2020, in the US, the market for EVs was basically flat, while in Europe there was a significant increase in demand in purchases of new EVs, or whether battery EVs or plug-in hybrid. I think that realization had a significant impact in customers' attitude towards EVs. The second thing, many European countries, as a mean, you know, to try to push the economy out of this pandemic, started offering greater rebates, incentives, or mandates to push the adoption of EVs. Germany has been the one with the most generous incentives, and they also introduced this mandate for gas stations to add EV chargers. And they've been very successful in moving the needle in demand. Other countries like Italy, for instance, they put in place incentives, but they put incentives a bit across the board, not just for EVs, in general for renewing your car with a new one, a better one, with better, you know, efficiency and lower emissions. But that also included, high efficiency internal combustion engines car. And the results there have been mixed. I think if you really want to push electrification, government should stop providing any sort of subsidy or incentive to internal combustion engines and make it really clear cut that policy. This is not different, however, from what United States has done in the past with the tax credit. And of course, the proposal now on the table from the new administration and the Congress on extending the tax credit beyond the existing limits are very welcome, because they for sure will push further even more electrification. But we are now at the point where electric vehicles are becoming are starting becoming almost mainstream, and the cost difference is going down by the day, and people are realizing that there are long-term benefit in having an electric car in terms of savings in maintenance and in fuel, and then there is the pleasure of driving that also plays a role. So I think these policies are important, have been very important, will continue to be important for a while, but we will soon reach the point where monetary incentives to EVs won't be needed anymore. The industry is investing massively in EVs, and we'll see costs going down dramatically. In Europe, they've also pushed the electrification of last mile, if you want to call it. So incentives for bikes and electric scooters. That is definitely interesting. And for locations, for big cities where there is a high density population, it makes sense to support those alternatives mean of transportation. Less relevant, of course, outside of the big cities.
Well, yes, no, I say certainly American OEMs have seemed to have cracked the marketing piece there with the F-150 Lightning and the Mach-E Mustang, and of course the electric Hummer forthcoming. I just hope we get to see an electric Vespa as well. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Giovanni.
It was a pleasure talking with you.
So that got me thinking, Jota, what would a world like shaped by like Italian mobility look like, right? Like, I mean, this is Italy, you know, Ferrari, Maserati, Vespas, but also like, you know, Gia, the electric robot that we had at the very first commotion from Vespa's, innovation agency. Mm-hmm. I would love to see what like their model of electric mobility would look like. What do you think that would be, a world of electric Vespas?
I mean, I'm down with the world of electric Vespas, right? I mean, funnily, my wife has sort of been, her dream vehicle, I think, is an electric Vespa. And there's just, I feel like it's something they've been promising for years, and maybe it's finally available in Europe, but not in the US. And you know, there's all sorts of flimsy looking knockoffs here, but she would love that just for doing little around town errands. But of course, that feels a lot more comfortable if you're on a European-sized, road or little piazza, and not a giant American Strode. But anything would beat Italian funicular technology, I suppose.
That is true, and it would not weigh 6,000 pounds. There would be that as well. All right. Well, great. Well, that brings us to the end of the episode. Jota, you want to tell our listeners what's coming up? Because we're in the home stretch now for Commotion Miami.
Yeah. And with that also means in the home stretch for this podcast season. So we'll have a few more fun guests, a little bit of insight into our upcoming great event, which is, of course, Commotion Miami Live, coming up in just a few weeks in June. If you're not getting the emails, you're missing out on all sorts of fun updates about the speakers, the programming, the in-person, networking opportunities. So I think this is going to be a super fun hybrid event. And I don't know, Greg, I'm sure you're looking forward to it too, no?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm here in Canada, so I'm not really in a position to enter the country for it. But if you're stateside and you can authorize some business travel, this is a great place to start. First event of the season. We're going to be the first out of the blocks back with live programming again of all the mobility conferences. So if you have missed seeing the usual suspects on the circuit, get out there, because a lot of them will be in Miami. So I would encourage you all. And if you can't make it, we'll have a whole live stream of programming. I'll be the MC again this year, so leading you from session to session. So yeah, we're going to be pioneering the sort of new hybrid format, which will likely be the format for the foreseeable future for a lot of conferences this year, before we all see you back in person in LA in November. So we can't wait to see you virtually or in person. All right. Well, with that, Jota, a pleasure as always. Thanks for coming on. And thank you again all for listening. We'll be back next week with our final guest episode of Commotion or the Fast Forward podcast, along with a preview episode and a recap after that before we hit the beach for summer. So until then, take care.